So we started with a reading from Matthew's Gospel, which will crop up in this talk, but we're mainly looking at the Old Testament book of Esther. We've been looking at this since the beginning of May. And just to recap, it's a rag-to-riches story that took place a few hundred years before the birth of Jesus. God's people are in exile from their city of Jerusalem and their motherland, and they're scattered all over the vast Persian Empire under the rule of King Xerxes. The story is set in the Persian capital called Susa. And it begins with King Xerxes being publicly humiliated by his wife, Queen Vashti, when she refuses to appear before his guests at a drunken feast. And because of this, Xerxes ditches her and she's banished. A process is put in place to find her replacement, and beautiful women are brought from all over the empire to meet King Xerxes in a kind of Miss Persia contest. Remarkably, Jewish orphan Esther is chosen to be the new queen of the vast Persian Empire. Sometime later, a man called Haman is given a seat of high honor amongst the nobles in Susa. Now, Esther had been adopted as a child by her cousin Mordecai. And as we learned a few weeks ago, Mordecai refused to bow to the newly elevated Haman. And this enraged him. He set in motion a plan to not simply get even with Mordecai, but to actually annihilate the Jewish people throughout the huge empire. An edict is signed with the king's seal and sent out from Susa all over the empire. And it says that on the 13th day of the 12th month of Adar, that's the last month in the Jewish calendar, all Jews were to be killed and annihilated, young and old, women and children, and their goods to be plundered. So this sets up the big tension in the story. And we're going to pick it up with our reading at this point, hearing chapters 4 to 5. So if the reading group would like to come out.
When Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, went out into the city, wailing loudly and bitterly. But he only went as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it. In every province to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her about Mordecai, she was in great distress. She sent clothes for him to put on instead of his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther summoned Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs assigned to attend her, and ordered him to find out what was troubling Mordecai and why. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, including the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay into the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show to Esther and explain it to her. And he told him to urge her to go into the king's presence to beg for mercy and plead with him for her people. Hathach went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai,
"All the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court, without being summoned, the king has but one law, that he be put to death. The only exception to this is for the king to extend the gold scepter to him and spare his life. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king."
When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer.
Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this?
Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai.
Go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa, and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish.
So Mordecai went away and carried out all of Esther's instructions. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the palace in front of the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the hall, facing the entrance. When he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her and held out to her the gold scepter that was in his hand. So Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. Then the king asked,
"What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be given to you."
"If it pleases the king,"
replied Esther,
"let the king, together with Haman, come today to a banquet I have prepared for him."
"Bring Haman at once,"
the king said,
"so that we may do what Esther asks."
So the king and Haman went to the banquet Esther had prepared. As they were drinking wine, the king again asked Esther,
"Now what is your petition? It will be given you. And what is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted."
Esther replied,
"My petition and my request is this. If the king regards me with favor, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come tomorrow to the banquet I will prepare for them. Then I will answer the king's question."
Haman went out that day happy and in high spirits. But when he saw Mordecai at the king's gate, and observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, he was filled with rage against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. Calling together his friends and Zeresh, his wife, Haman boasted to them about his vast wealth, his many sons, and all the ways the king had honored him, and how he had elevated him above the other nobles and officials.
"And that's not all,"
Haman added.
"I'm the only person Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave. And she has invited me along with the king tomorrow. But all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate."
His wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him,
"Have a gallows built 75 feet high and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go with the king to dinner and be happy."
This suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the gallows built.
Thank you very much. So I want to focus on two key phrases in these chapters, and then to look at Esther's approach to this situation, how she deals with it. So firstly, chapter 4, verse 14, "for such a time as this." This is really quite a famous phrase in the book of Esther. Mordecai and Esther find themselves in this crisis situation. And Mordecai presses her that the purpose of her circumstances that she finds herself in, this incredible move from being nobody to being queen of the empire, is part of God's plan for such a time as this, to save her people from Haman's edict. Mordecai uses this interesting expression, "If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place." Why does he say that? Well, it seems Mordecai is confident that God has a purpose to perpetuate the Jewish people. He believes that God has made a covenant with the Jewish people as it's laid out in the Old Testament. And God's honor is bound up with this covenant. So he believes that even if he and Esther die, God will bring deliverance for the Jewish people as a whole from somewhere else. So even if they don't survive themselves, he'll still maintain the Jewish people. So he believes that Esther has a choice as to whether or not she gets involved. God will keep his covenant whichever way she acts. But the question is, will she identify with God's people in their time of need? Up until this point, she's kept her Jewish identity private, both from her husband, King Xerxes, and from his court. She might think that she'll be all right, and she'll escape the genocide because of her position. But Mordecai presses her, verse 14, do not think that because you're in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. And who knows but that you have come to this royal position for such a time as this. This is Esther's defining moment. Will she risk her own life for the sake of her people? Or will she keep silent, unconcerned for them and for God's covenant? And in this, there's a simple challenge for us. To what extent do you identify with God's people? To what extent are you concerned about the welfare of God's church? Are you prepared to associate with other Christians in difficult circumstances? Now, many of you were here for Tim and Melody's wedding yesterday. We can still see the remains of the extravaganza that happened yesterday. Melody's parents were unable to fly over from China, and a good friend of Melody's called Henry took the place of her father, so to speak, for the day. He gave her away. And in his speech, one thing particularly struck me. Henry said that one of the first things that he noticed about Melody when he first met her in China, she was working as part of an underground, unregistered church, which is quite a risky thing to do in China. And he said that he was really struck immediately by her concern for the church. He noticed how she identified strongly with them and was concerned for their welfare. Now, China is, this is the Open Doors World Persecution Map that I showed you a few weeks ago. Last time we were looking at North Korea, which is the hardest place to be a Christian at the moment. China is 13th on their ranking and comes under that yellow category of severe limitations. So it's a difficult place to be a Christian, and particularly if you're involved in these unregistered churches. But Melody was very much prepared to be involved and to associate with God's people. At some point in the next few months, Melody will be joining the staff team here in order to work with international students at Royal Holloway. And I think if half of what Henry said is true, we're going to be very blessed to have her as part of the church and on the staff team. Melody identified and associated with God's people in a country where it's difficult to do that. Well, coming back to our situation in the UK, let's take school for a moment. If you're in school, are you prepared to associate with other Christians, even if they aren't cool, even if it's slightly embarrassing and awkward to be known to be their friend? Some of you are going to university for the first time this autumn. Will you join with other Christians, being associated with them? Will you associate with Christians on your course or on the corridor where you live? Are you prepared to associate with Christians in your workplace? Will you stand with other Christians even when it might affect your job prospects? Will you stand with persecuted Christians in this country or abroad through the ministry of Open Doors? What will you do if such a time arrives when you have a defining moment? What will you do? Which way will you turn? Will you associate and identify with God's people, or will you turn away and keep quiet? Jesus wants us to associate publicly with himself and with his people. And he so identifies with his people, his followers, that he calls them his body. He refers to us, Jesus refers to us as his body. In the book of Acts, we learn of a man called Saul who persecuted and hated the church. He actively went out of his way to harass and even kill the first Christians. Saul was dramatically converted when he met Jesus in a supernatural encounter. And Jesus said some amazing words to him that day. And they're recorded in Acts chapter 9. He said, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" That's an amazing thing for Jesus to say, because Saul was persecuting Christians. But Jesus took it personally. Jesus so identifies with Christians that when Saul persecuted them, Jesus said, "Why do you persecute me?" This is how strongly Jesus associates with his followers. Esther faced the challenge. Will she associate and identify with God's people in that hour of need? Will you identify and associate with his followers? In our first reading from Matthew's Gospel, we heard some very strong words from Jesus. "Whoever acknowledges me before men, I will acknowledge him before my Father in heaven. But whoever disowns me before men, I will disown him before my Father in heaven." To be disowned before God the Father would be terrible. We must avoid this at all costs. Will Esther associate with God's people, or will she disown them? It's like Peter after Jesus was arrested. Jesus predicted, "This very night before the cock crows, you will disown me three times." That's exactly what Peter did. When the day of crisis comes, whatever that might be, will you associate with God's people? Will you stand up and be counted alongside other Christians? Or will you, so to speak, evaporate and just kind of melt away? This was Esther's challenge, and she chose the good path. The story of Peter does, by the way, show us that there is still hope if we desert Jesus. There is still hope of restoration. But this is a big challenge for us. Which path will you choose? How will you prepare your heart for when the moment of challenge comes? Sometimes it can come in an instant. You have to make an instantaneous reaction. Are you going to respond by saying something that associates you with the person who's been persecuted or put down? Or will you just keep quiet? So you need to prepare in advance. Esther chose the good path, which brings us to the second phrase I want to look at for this evening. "If I perish, I perish." Chapter 4, verse 16. Esther tells Mordecai that she will risk her own life by going to ask the king against the protocol of the royal court. And we heard last week about the culture there. If you came into the king's court without being summoned, you could be executed. It was that severe. So she risks her life. Verse 15. Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. "Go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it's against the law. And if I perish, I perish." It's Esther's defining moment. She's going to identify with God's people. She's going to put her life on the line for their sake. She's chosen the potentially painful but right path. And we see this attitude mirrored in Jesus and in what he asks of his followers. His very incarnation, his becoming a human being, was for the sake of saving his people, the church. Jesus Christ came into the world to save sinners. He took the hard road to the cross. He paid the price for our sakes. And he calls us to do the same. In Matthew chapter 10, verse 38, he calls on us to take up our cross for his sake. Anyone who does not take up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Now this expression, to take up your cross, has very much passed into the English language. We all have our crosses to bear, is another way it's framed. And it's so penetrated the culture that it's used equally by old ladies and 20-something songwriters. But what does it really mean? Because it's used in rather a light way compared with what Jesus was saying. Taking up your cross means walking a road towards one's own death. So you'd carry your crossbeam on your shoulders and walk to your execution, which is exactly what Jesus did himself. Jesus demands such loyalty from his followers. To be a disciple, Jesus says, is to be prepared to die for his sake and for the sake of his followers. And this is the example that we see in Esther. She was prepared to die for the sake of the Jewish people. If I perish, I perish. Would you ever say that? Would you ever be prepared to go to that point? This is your calling as a Christian disciple. This is part of Christian discipleship. And it's very scary because we fear death. Jesus, interestingly, distinguishes in that passage we heard from Matthew between the death of the body and the death of the soul. He says, Matthew 10:28, "Do not be afraid of those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul." So, i.e., don't be afraid of other people. It's not the death of your body that you should fear. Rather, be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul and body in hell. Who's he talking about there? He's talking about God. God is the one who can destroy our soul and body in hell. And Jesus says that it's him that we should be afraid of, not other people. That may be quite a challenging thing for some of you to hear. God is the one to fear, not other people who threaten us. So when the hour of need comes, the moment of crisis, be it big or small, local or national, one person or many, will you take up your cross for the sake of Jesus' people? If I perish, I perish. Well, let's finish by looking at Esther's method. She's taken up the challenge, and let's see what she does as she goes to work in chapter 5. Mordecai, interestingly, urged Esther in chapter 4, verse 8, to go into the king's presence, to beg for mercy, and to plead with him for her people. So she could have gone into the inner court, fallen before him, turned on the taps, and begged for mercy. But she doesn't choose this approach. She's canny, as they say in Newcastle. Instead, she invites the king to dinner, and she invites Haman to come along as well. The king is delighted, and so is Haman. At this point, Haman doesn't realize that Esther is Jewish, and he boasts to his wife, Zeresh, and her friends in chapter 5, verse 12, "I'm the only person, Queen Esther, invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave." Even at the banquet, Esther won't tell Xerxes her request. She strings it out. Instead, she invites him and Haman to dine again the next day. She plays it very cool. And this shows us that there are more ways than one to deal with a difficult situation. Head on isn't always the most effective. I think it's fair to say that Esther makes the most of her femininity in this situation. She's virtually powerless compared with Xerxes and Haman. In chapter 1, we saw how former Queen Vashti was banished on the king's whim. What tools does Esther have? Not a lot. But she has her beauty and she has her training in the social etiquette of the Persian court. I would never be able to exercise this kind of social skill as Esther did. I'm naturally much more confrontational rather than being circumspect. And Esther gives us cause to reflect on our normal strategies for handling important and difficult situations. Can we learn other ways of dealing with situations which may be more helpful in serving God's people? I wonder what your instinctive strategies and approaches are. Maybe you could reflect and look at the way other people deal with things. Look at the way Esther dealt with this and think if there are better strategies that you can employ. Haman is so chuffed that he's been invited. But upon leaving the feast, he sees Mordecai, and again he's filled with rage. He goes home and brags to his friends. Everything's going brilliantly for him, except for Mordecai. Mordecai's the fly in his ointment. Chapter 5, verse 13. All his success gives him no satisfaction as long as he sees that Jew, Mordecai, sitting at the king's gate. And the 13th day of the 12th month of Adar is still a long way away. That's the Jewish calendar that I showed you last time. Adar is the final month in the Jewish calendar. So his wife and his friends suggest that he build an enormous 75-foot gallows and ask the king the next morning, before Queen Esther's second feast day, for permission to hang Mordecai on it. Then go to dinner and be happy, they say. This suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the gallows built. It is great to have friends who agree with you, isn't it? And support you in your schemes. So what's going to happen next? He's upped the ante with this huge gallows. Well, tune in next Sunday at 6:30 p.m. for the next exciting installment of the Esther story. In summary, we've considered the importance of identifying and associating with other followers of Jesus, particularly in times of difficulty. We've heard Jesus' challenge to take up our cross in being prepared to risk our lives for the sake of him and his church. And we've seen in Esther methods that there are various different ways to approach our goals when we're looking to serve the church. Being prepared to risk our lives for Jesus doesn't always require us to be blunt and tactless. There are all other more subtle ways of doing it.